It's Torah Clark.
Here we go. We'd like to welcome everybody today to On Point with your hosts, Don Allen and Ron Edwards. And actually, Mr. Edwards is on assignment in Omaha, Nebraska. How's everything down there, Mr. Edwards?
First of all, good afternoon, Don, to you and certainly our listening audience, both domestic and international. It is a beautiful day here in Omaha. Temperatures are around 62. In fact, it's really cleared up skies, a bright blue, if you will. And there is just almost a frenzy, a euphoria here in Omaha because their Omaha Nighthawks of the United Football League will be entertaining the Sacramento Mountain Lions of Coach Dennis Green, the legendary winning coach of the Minnesota Vikings, if you will. And, of course, one of the great players and students of the game, Dante Culpepper. Dante will be starting for Sacramento. And interesting enough, Don, his opposite number for the Nighthawks will be the 14-year veteran Jeff Garcia, played in the Super Bowl for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers a couple years ago. So things are really big. We had breakfast together. In fact, as we speak here from the Crown Plaza Studios, and they have set up an excellent mobile studio here at the Crown Plaza Complex in Northwest Omaha.
Okay.
Is a final dinner is taking place as well as a prayer meeting. Coach Green has his players on a very rigid schedule, but at the same time, the importance of fellowship, humanity is all about what it is. But I got to tell you, I was in Des Moines early on yesterday en route here, and last night it was just unbelievable. What's happening here in Omaha, I mean, the folks have really fallen in love with this team. The game is sold out at Johnny Rosenblatt Stadium, which those who are from Omaha or the Omaha area know where that stadium is at. A converted baseball stadium, really, though they're building a new ballpark. But Rosenblatt, 24,000 tickets, then there will be almost 3,000 standing room only, Don.
Wow, that's absolutely great. Now, I understand that with Dante Culpepper tonight, there's a celebrity son that you met down there in the Crown Plaza Studios at the banquet and things that is playing for with Culpepper tonight. Who might that be?
Well, Don, you've been on your research. I was surprised. I remember I had been told it kind of slipped the memory. But I had a chance to meet the son of Denzel Washington, who is one of the running backs for the Mountain Lions. Just a fine young man. I mean, just kind of a image as it pertains to personality and et cetera of his dad. John David Washington.
He's playing at 5'9", 208, right? 208 pounds?
That's right.
Yes.
Muscular
yes.
Young kid, kind of got to walk, walks like his dad, by the way. he's in his second season in the UFL, and we expect him to see him tonight. He's on special teams, and he's third on the depth chart at running back, but just a fine young man. It was exciting for me to see the son of a great American legend, Denzel Washington. But, you know, I wouldn't have guessed it, but then on the other hand, over the years we watched Denzel, and you could tell that he himself has those athletic kinds of moves and built. But, yeah, John David Washington, the son of Denzel Washington, will be on the field, kickoff time 7:30 here in Omaha. And I got to tell you, it's a beautiful day, and this town is pumped up, man, I got to tell you.
Okay. Sounds good. We want to let everybody know that you are broadcasting live from the Crown Plaza Studios in Omaha, Nebraska, and we're here at the McIntosh Studios overlooking downtown Minneapolis, where it is 50 degrees, windy, partly cloudy, little sun peeking through every now and then, but otherwise, you know, you're 12 degrees ahead of us down there.
Yes, we are, and I knew the weather was kind of adverse there in the Twin Cities Early on, we had a chance to watch the last quarter of another unfortunate Gopher defeat to Northwestern. Northwestern coming from behind to defeat the Minnesota Gophers, if you will, and kind of sad. I don't think Tim Brewster has any time left after this season, but hey, right now we're looking at a real positive down here, and I tell you, it's just a lot of excitement. Too bad we don't have that same kind of excitement up in Minneapolis. Though the Vikings, hey, Don, I told you the Vikings stumbled 2-1 last week.
Yes.
They have a bye this week, which they probably need.
Yeah, that will relax me a little bit, I guess. So I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Virtual Global Media Network in Toronto, Canada. And we want to give a special shout-out to locally here. We have a really big show today, Mr. Edwards, and some of the things that we're going to be dealing with has been covered by a group called the Jordan Hotman Group. And I would just like to give them a personal shout-out and thank you very much for holding folks accountable in that area, that blighted area designated by HUD, North Minneapolis, and making sure that people, you know, dot their I's and cross their T's. But we'll talk more about that later.
Okay.
Any more sports updates down there? Everyone looking
healthy? Well, again, the situation here in Omaha, the Omaha World Herald, the prime newspaper here, just on the sports page, a full page picture of quarterback Dante Culpepper, talking in terms of a memorable game that he played here in Nebraska in 1997. But the community here, Warren Buffett's big money at play, if you will, and this may be, as we've said before, on point, may be the only professional football game in the United States. I would initially say the North American continent, but there's a heck of a league north of us called the Canadian Football League. But the UFL may be the only professional ball game in the United States next year. I've had some interesting discussions over the last 2 days, if you will. I'll share them with you in private as it pertains to the lockout, what's really at play, and some of the moves that the United Football League is making to fill that void next season if there's a lockout. So that's a part of the sports scene. By the way, the highly touted now 2-1, I think, Miami Heat, you remember them.
Yes.
Who everybody was so ticked off at LeBron James joining Chris Bosh, and of course my man Dwayne Wade out of who was with the Miami Heat. Miami Heat open up exhibition season. A lot of expectations, if you will. I think it's going to be a fascinating season in the NBA. Too bad the Minnesota Timberwolves won't be able to catch up. Oops, or keep up.
Yes, exactly.
So that's it from the sports end on this end here again in northwest Omaha, baby. I got to tell you, it is beautiful here today.
I wish I was there. and so we'll cross my fingers. Maybe I'll get a chance to go next year. We're here again live in the McIntosh Studios, downtown Minneapolis, overlooking the beautiful city, the lakes west of the city here. We have a few guests. That's going to be joining us here on Point. And those guests that are on hold here will be right with you here. But I'd like to start with first talking with Ms. Leah Hargett. She is the president of the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce, and they hosted its annual meeting at the University of Minnesota's Urban Research and Outreach Center in North Minneapolis, otherwise known as UROC. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is looking forward with their new goals and strategies. Today, the president, Leah Hargett, is going to be on the air with us. And Ms. Hargett, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Welcome. Glad to have you.
Well, yeah, we welcome you broadcasting from Minnesota to China to New Zealand, all across the world here, and we're glad to have you here. How's everything going?
Everything's great.
Okay.
Everything's great. We're still just kind of floating from the success of our meeting on the 29th, which it was really nice to see you there as well.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. You know, for our national and international listeners, Ms. Hargett, please give us a brief overview of the Minneapolis Chamber, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, including its history, structure, and current membership base, if you would.
Sure. Founded in 2000, we were originally known as the Metropolitan Area African American Chamber of Commerce. And then in 2004, we reorganized as a 501c3 and renamed the organization the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce. We're affiliated with the National Black Chamber of Commerce. At our inception, our chamber consisted of about 40 active business leaders who were engaged in a variety of industries that included but wasn't limited to manufacturing, wholesale, retail, professional services, and nonprofit organizations. The chamber is governed currently by a board of directors. It retains an executive committee, which is comprised of its board president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer. They manage the operation. And then the directors of the chamber are all of African descent. They're all successful business owners who volunteer their time to lead the various standing committees of the board where the work gets done. The chamber is a statewide organization. We represent approximately 4,000 businesses of African descent throughout Minnesota.
Okay, wow. You know, when I first, you know, found out that you were the president of the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce, I went ahead and did a little research, and it seems to me that you are the process person that this agency needed right now. And so, but what I want to ask you is, when did you assume the role of the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce president?
I assumed the president's role in December 2009, but I've served on the board since 2006.
Okay. Well, what strategies has the chamber developed to achieve the goals that you plan for the rest of 2010-2011?
Well, you know, our goals for 2000, well, our goals moving forward really are to promote and improve the general welfare and prosperity and of the community of African descent. As president, I only have one goal, which is to change the business landscape in Minnesota. You know, one of our major objectives will be to launch a statewide membership campaign in 2011. And also in the upcoming year, our strategic priority areas are economic development, future leadership development, and organizational infrastructure. You know, we will work very hard to strengthen the chamber's voice and get our message out through new and creative means such as this. We also plan to continue to call attention to the state of the economy and its impact on small business owners and make sure that our message is heard inside our state's legislative halls around the important role that business plays in creating jobs and revitalizing the community. We also intend to push our legislators and policymakers to make the necessary capital available to our businesses. We internally are looking to grow the board of directors to increase our capacity to influence and to tactically implement our strategies and help us gain greater financial support for our organization.
Okay. You know, the topic of our show today, overall topic, is the state of the African-American community. There are some systemic, challenges that have faced the black community, including the business community. What key issues are facing the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce?
Well, key issues that face our organization are is our ability to connect our businesses to new business opportunities, as well as assist them with their business, assisting their businesses directly to obtain the necessary capital to expand and create jobs. I mean, that is absolutely essential for us to be able to add value and to help revitalize our communities, which, you know, is really very important. You know, we're also challenged with helping startup businesses, and then when we look within, we're also, again, challenged with growing our financial base, staffing, and infrastructure, all of which is, again, in line with our priorities as we continue to move forward over the next several years.
Okay, and I got a couple more questions for you. Mr. Edwards, I did some research and had some questions, some specific questions.
Well, go right ahead. I'm just waiting.
For Ms. Haggard, so I want to make sure that we get through these. I'm a business owner, personally. I'm speaking for myself. What do I have to do to become a member? And then I want to also throw out, what are the benefits of my particular business joining or having a membership with the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce?
Sure, that's a great question. The first thing to do would be to complete and submit a membership application, and you would just simply visit our website at www.minnesotabcc.org. You'd click, the membership application is available online. Complete that application and mail the application in, and when you've done that, you've completed the most important step in becoming a member. Becoming a member helps us to continue to strengthen our organization and bring you greater value in the future. And I just want to say that we offer membership to those who are of African and non-African descent. Whether you are an individual or professional or student, small or large business, public or private, institution or association, we have a membership that's available. The benefits that we provide to our membership base are business and social networking, business-to-business connections, business referrals, business promotional opportunities, as well as business education. The Chamber works to promote its members' products and services, and it provides business education and networking to help you and your business remain in the public eye.
Okay, for our international and national listeners, we'll have that link to the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce posted on our homepage, on our show page, so you can just click there and become a member of the Minnesota Black Chamber of Commerce. And Ms. Haggard says she's inviting everybody, so we want all our listeners, national and international, to join this great organization. So to learn more, they can actually go to your website because you answered that. Mr. Edwards, do you have any questions?
I certainly do. And once again, welcome, Ms. Haggard, and we certainly appreciate you taking time off your busy schedule to join us here. A couple of questions. With respect to the MBCC, okay, it's 2008. The economy is starting to go belly up. You indicated you came aboard in 2006 as a board member and certainly took on the awesome responsibilities in December of 2009, to set the organization on a chartered course. Tell us just a little bit about your strategy and your planning at a very crucial time in the economic history of this country. It's late 2008. We're also in the midst of a presidential election. The bottom is falling out. Lending institutions have disappeared. God thank the stimulus. Could you share with us just a little bit about your strategic planning in 2008 moving into 2009?
Well, in 2008, what we were focused on is, in addition to trying to keep our heads above water, we were focused on trying to build a solid infrastructure and an influential base. So, we were trying at that particular time to strengthen the brand of the chamber so that we could continue to avail that brand or make that brand of value to our members and call attention, and then that way we would be able to call attention to the state of the economy and the impact of our small businesses. We began to cultivate really key relationships with some of our legislative and policymakers here in the state of Minnesota, meeting with them, getting them familiar with who we are, who our constituent base is, as well as what their challenges were. So we began to start kind of laying foundation for our organization to build on, and that's what we're able to now stand upon and move our organization forward.
All right, the 2011 legislative session, you just touched on the legislative initiative. Without giving away any trade secrets, if you will, what expectations do you have coming out of the 2011 legislative session that you feel will enhance the African-American economic community?
Well, our strategy is to build our membership base so that we increase our voice and our influence with that legislative body. We know that numbers speak a lot, and that if you bring 4,000 voices with you, you can influence a lot of what happens in this country. We have just recently aligned ourselves with the Color the Vote campaign here in Minnesota, and the chamber, along with the Latino, the Asian, and the Native American communities, are working together to get out the vote on November 2nd. Currently there are approximately 300,000 voters in the community of color, of which in 2006 only 21,000 came out to vote. Our goal is to get everyone out on November 2nd. This is an important election. As a matter of fact, it is the most important election we will ever be involved in. Every decision that's made by the next governor will affect our community. So voting will give us a seat and a voice at the table with the next governor. It will help the MBCC. It will help the collective communities of color to begin to make a difference in their communities. It helps us to build a stronger advocacy base. So we appeal to our community to join us in changing the face of Minnesota politics. And again, it's through our collective involvement that we will make a real difference. Now, I want to make another plug. To learn more about the Color the Vote campaign and the issues, we recommend that your listeners go to www.colorthevote.org. Or go to our Facebook page called Color the Vote.
One additional question, one final question for me on this end. You've talked in terms of coloring the vote, get out the vote, and et cetera. Now, do you have you developed a relationship with the political PAC group known as IMPACT? Are you working with them?
I'm not sure if I know who that group is by name, and perhaps with individuals I have.
Okay. Did you see their big ad in one of our local African American papers last week?
Yeah.
No, I didn't, sir.
Okay. Yeah, they had a big ad, full page ad on the back page.
Okay.
They're located at 1500 West Broadway. I was just wondering, based on the legislative initiatives, if they were working closely with the MBCC.
They have not contacted me at this point.
Okay. I certainly appreciate your time, and I appreciate the very candid responses and answers. Anything for you, Mr. Allen?
Well, I would like to say thank you to Ms. Leah Hargett for calling us. We are in full support of the MBCC, and maybe about a week off the Saturday before the election, maybe we could have you and a representative from Color the Vote call in, and we can spread that information around for you. We're always willing to help you. We have the Independent Business News Network, and Mr. Edwards is a weekly columnist in the Spokesman Recorder and has his own blog called The Minneapolis Story, and I'm sure the Jordan Hotman group would hop on board on this. So, again, thank you, Ms. Hargett, for calling, and we welcome you here at Blog Talk Radio's On Point at any time.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
By the way, on that note, was in anticipation of this call in and interview this afternoon, we were doing some research on the Omaha, on the MBCC's counterpart here in Omaha and quote-unquote Nebraska. Okay. In fact, on tomorrow, Don, we will be going out, we'll be flying out early in the morning to Alliance, Nebraska, which has a very rich African-American history. You'd be surprised. Similar to Fergus Falls, okay, a former railroad repair center, a very interesting, small but very historical black population there in Alliance, Nebraska. And we're going to be doing a piece in a concert with a couple of your Pacific entities, probably in December, a documentary. So just wanted to kind of give folks a heads up to that. Alliance, Nebraska, fantastic history and both personal and economic survival for over 100 and some years.
Okay, Mr. Edwards, we have another caller here, and I think this is our other guest. Hello, who are you? Who's on the line here?
Sherilyn LaChapelle.
Okay, great. Just stand by, Ms. Sherilyn LaChapelle, because we're getting ready to move to that segment. Mr. Edwards, the topic of our show today was the state of the African-American community, and we know people, our listeners and people national and international know that if you are a Caucasian person living in a black neighborhood, we'll take, for instance, maybe 554-11 and 554-05, that's North Minneapolis for our national and international listeners, that the numbers fall the same for you as it does the minority ethnic population.
Mm-hmm.
So with that said, I was just reviewing, we had Mr. Lenny Chisholm on the air a week or so ago. And
Last week.
Last week, yeah. And he was talking about the numbers for MnDOT. The last 10 years, over $6 billion spent on Minnesota's roads, highways, and bridges, and less than a fifth.
0.2%.
Yeah, was spent in the minority ethnic community. And I just want to position something, because when people hear us talk, you know, about the minority ethnic community or unfairness to blacks and things like that, that is not just a color-specific number or argument, okay? It's a community-based argument or an area-based argument. I mean, HUD came to Minnesota and looked at North Minneapolis, okay? They didn't pick out North Minneapolis and say, okay, there's black people here, and it's good, we're making a blighted zone. They looked at the whole area, Asian, Russian, African-American, Hispanic, Latino, and determined that this is a blighted area. We you know, you have $70 million already this year going into North Minneapolis, and you see no effects. You see, I mean, it's the same thing. Broadway Avenue looks the same. You have independent contractors, you know, basically getting rich on Broadway Avenue, and there's nothing trickled down for jobs, economic development. For
nothing at all. And let me just say this, Mr. Allen. Mr. Chisholm's presentation, which was not absent specific documentation, because I understand there are some white bloggers around the north side who hide in the dark shadows and et cetera, who have tried to say that we need to be taken to the task. I most certainly welcome them to have the guts to pick up the phone and call in so that we can both identify them and then debate with them what is happening, because the African-American community is just being absolutely devastated economically. But go ahead. Let's get our caller on and see what she has to say.
Well, we'd like to welcome Ms. Sherilyn LaChapelle to the show. Ms. LaChapelle is, let me just get down her screen so I don't mess up, is the president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Black Nurses Association. Ms. LaChapelle, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. And Don, I'm going to have to correct you. It's Sherilyn LaChapelle.
Oh, okay. I forgot the French.
I'm not
LaChapelle.
Related to
Welcome, Ms. LaChapelle.
I'm not related to me.
Okay. What do you have for us?
Money, though. Well, I want to talk about health disparities in our community, and that's a really big issue. And part of what the Minnesota chapter of the National Black Nurses Association is about ending those disparities. We are a group of nurses, healthcare professionals, who have come together to help to educate our community and also to interact in a way that could end these disparities. There's some very important things as an intermediary group that we can do. We can work with other stakeholders within the community who are interested in ending these disparities, healthcare organizations, the public health department, MOAP. There are various other ones, but we also want to work with those groups who are educating our young people in grammar school and high school and get them interested in going into the helping professions, be it nursing or other healthcare professionals. We are also working with the multicultural Medical Students Association at the University of Minnesota, who also want to impact these issues. We are interested in having community health workers operate in a very capable and professional manner, and we're interested in making sure they're trained appropriately so that they can go out and do what they do best. And there are things that nurses do, these community health workers need to be about doing, and that they can interact with our public a lot better than on a face-to-face, one-on-one level.
Okay.
Let me ask this question, because I know there are a lot of health professionals out there that are certainly hearing your message or will hear your message. Is there a regular format that the Black Nurses Association has so that people maybe can find out when you meet and, you know, participate and share information and concerns?
Well, we're working on our website, but we do have our meetings on the third Sunday of the month from 2:30 until 4 p.m. at the Lutheran Social Services Building, 2400 Park Avenue South, first floor conference room. Mm-hmm. And this will be the 17th of this month, and I think the 19th of November are our meeting dates. So October the 17th, 2:30 p.m., 2400 Park Avenue South, November the 19th, same address. And we would love to have nursing students, LPNs, RNs, advanced practice nurses, doctorates. This is something that we are partnered, again, with the National Association on ending health disparities, and we really need to build capacity, and we're right now doing that. We've developed some key partnerships with the State Health Department, the Hypertension and Cardiovascular Disease Unit has decided to partner with us on ending those issues having to do with hypertension, stroke, and cardiovascular disease.
Could you just indicate for both our domestic and international audiences the lay of the land here physically, if you will? What are the five most dangerous areas facing the African American population right now? You've talked in terms of kind of high blood pressure / hypertension. What about other areas such as HIV and things like that? Could you give us the top five as you know them?
Oh, well, definitely more of us are dying from HIV. Quite a few. But obesity, we've got to put that in. And when I put in obesity, and let's don't forget murder and suicide and depression. But when I say obesity, if we can deal with obesity, we're going to deal with hypertension, heart attack, stroke. Because you lose weight a lot, and diabetes, if you lose weight a lot of times, we can back up on some of that medication that people are on. But we also, again, have to learn how to eat appropriately. We need access to healthy food that's affordable. We need access to affordable housing that is safe. These are stressors that cause hypertension again, and there are, when you say top five, some of these are intermarried. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
If you're living in an unsafe community, you're going to be stressed out. You're going to be hypertensive. You're not going to have adequate housing. Probably there's not a grocery store within a mile of your home, and that's probably a two-bus ride trip to the store, probably carrying two or more children with you.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this question as it pertains to both preparation and funding. First Lady Michelle Obama has really taken up this obesity issue, and in fact I saw a piece on CNN on her in the Mississippi Delta, and she's really been calling attention, and it's ironic that there were some things that she wanted to do that we all thought that the Congress of the United States was going to pass some legislation and do some funding before they recessed to go home to try to get reelected again. Are you in contact as a more national group or even a local group with the office of the First Lady on her her programs dealing with obesity and other health areas?
this organization is not, but the national is. And I went to the national conference, and the Chicago organization in particular, which my sister is a member, and I used to be.
As
they
Michelle's
are very much. We are very much, and we are partnering with them, and we are lockstep with them on working to prevent, community gardening, definitely for that, and we're going to have a conversation with some people who are actively doing community gardening in all areas. We need community greenhouses, in fact, since we are a colder climate, so that we can farm year-round and provide food needed, fruits and vegetables to our community, especially those who can least afford it. They need this access. So absolutely.
Let me ask you now this question, because you've touched on some things, and the reason I asked you the question about the five top areas of concern. Earlier this week, Johnson & Johnson, who makes Moton's, had a very tough session with a committee dealing with health care, chaired by Elijah Cummings, the Democrat, black Democrat out of Maryland. Morton, Johnson & Johnson realized that there was a problem with the drug or slash aspirin, Moton, and did a very peculiar kind of recall, if you will. What have you and what has been your reflection, either locally or nationally, on this whole thing of experimental medicine in the black community?
Excuse me, Ron. When you say experimental medicine, I need you to define that just so I got it.
Experimental medicine, let me give you an example. Pharmaceutical companies experiment all the time. They put drugs out on the market. Sometimes the FDA approves it. Sometimes they give them a certain authorization and certain latitude. And there is a body of documentation that indicates that communities of color and communities economically poor are oftentimes, unfortunately, the targets of a lot of this experimental kind of medicine. The genesis for my concern had to do with a situation that happened here many years ago, 1972 to be exact, though the person who put their reputation and career on the line and lost basically everything is still with us, and that's Leah Samuels, and want to wish her a belated happy birthday. Miss Samuels worked for the American Red Cross. And for years prior to 1972 and since then, the University of Minnesota has made a nice piece of money within their research component in the area of sickle cell and research on sickle cell, which included helping the pharmaceutical industry develop clotting medication and et cetera. Ms. Samuels exposed the fact that it was a sham. Unfortunately, she lost her job with the American Red Cross, lost her career, and has never been retained in any kind of position. There's a lot of controversy around the initial intention of the University of Minnesota when Dr. Jaketti was brought here. And so that is the genesis for the question, and that is my response to what specifically am I saying. Any response?
Well, I can't really respond to what happened to Liz, and I know Liz. She's a great woman. Happy birthday, Liz. But I'm going to deviate a little bit. And I'm going to give you a perspective that has to do with today, right now. Unfortunately, a lot of these medications that are on the market have not been, tested on us. And when they provide a lot, when they prescribe some of these medicines to us, they react differently, you know, with our genetics for whatever reason. And some of the hypertensive antihypertensives don't work as well on us as they do on the European population. So, yes and no. Research is very important. It's the only way. Yes, it's been abused in the past. But without adequate research, it's the only way we can find cures for a lot of diseases. It's the only way that we can come up with a better way of treating various diseases that affect us disproportionately. While we may not trust the university from past experience, it doesn't mean that they may not do good work in the future as long as they are observed and that we have people who are working alongside to make sure that the needs of the community and the community as a whole are protected. Does that make sense?
Oh, certainly, certainly. But
yes.
I have to disagree with you to the extent that that past practices / past history is, in fact, not important, because if you don't know how you were misdiagnosed in the past, you won't understand how you will be intentionally misdiagnosed in the future. But what you've said is certainly something that needs to definitely be worked on. Mr. Allen, anything from your end?
Well, yeah. I mean, since we're having the conversation even about health disparities, and Ms. LaChapelle knows this already, and this is something that, you know, we've talked about here on the show from the beginning and on our respective news outlets for years. We know in the last 10 years, HIV/AIDS rate for black women in North Minneapolis, 13 to 18 years old, is one of the highest in the country.
Yes.
Yet there's been funding, multi-million dollars of funding. The last time I actually researched the funding, we were up around about $20 million and plus, and that was about 3 years ago. And so how does this happen? And I guess the question, it's not really a question for you, because I know you guys are, I mean, you're out there. I see you, Sherilyn, I see you everywhere at all these meetings, and you're proactive rather than reactive, which is how the black community or the minority ethnic community, including the Caucasian folks who in North Minneapolis, need to operate. But this funding you have, and we don't hold any punches here, you have North Point Health and Wellness, okay? Prostate screening, I haven't heard anything. You have the African American Men Project. I had some lady hand me a flyer for Black Men Reading, okay? We have black men dying in the street. I'm sure they don't give a damn about reading right now. Let's focus on something that's going to work with, you know, with the community. You have the Minneapolis Urban League, the social wellness cluster, okay? And that's a bit another ball of wax. The stop smoking sensation classes, which they used to have, the obesity stuff they used to have. I mean, where is this? My thing is, where is the money going? Is there someone that can do it better? Are we going to have to get Bobby Joe, Representative Bobby Joe Champion, Congressman Keith Ellison on the stick and say, hey, guys, okay, we need to refocus the existing funds? Because you know, Ms. LaChapelle, the first thing they tell you is that we don't have any money. Okay, well, what we have to do is then come back to them and say, well, why don't we redirect the current funding streams? Okay,
absolutely, Don. Absolutely.
Because they're not working where they're at now. So I guess my question is, it's not really a question, but I'm glad that you're doing this, and I'm glad the process is taking effect, because I hear a lot about, you know, what you're doing out in the community. And we need to make sure that this is a focused effort and a supported effort, because usually we don't get supported, because, you know, right now you got, you know, the black leadership. Is it more important turning off Fox News or focusing on leadership, you know, and rather than, you know, there's some issues happening here in the community that are detrimental to our health and wellness. And I don't see any solutions right now.
Well, Don, if I could interject.
Yes, you
That's
can.
Why the black nurses are so important. Around this nation, there are over 70-some chapters, including we've had a new chapter that came up in Toronto, and they came down to the convention in San Diego. And I think we have one in Jamaica. But around these issues, nursing historically has been the profession that has worked with the populace. We are the caring profession. We are the ones who are out there hand in glove with the people, educating folk on how to stay healthy, how to, well, let's just say Florence Nightingale showed them that washing your hands would stop passing infection from patient to patient or soldier to soldier during the Crimean War. Nurses have historically been those who have worked with the public in the public and as a public health model to change the behaviors in society that have brought sickness and disease. we are always involved in education on hypertension, birth control, even though some people may not believe in birth control and how to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. They just say no, and we already know that doesn't work.
Exactly.
Young people are going to do what they're going to do, and our best means is to work with people where they are. Yes, we need to build some new leadership, and the young people are where we need to start. That's why we've got to educate these young people, mentor them, bring them along, because they are the future. They are the leadership. They are the nurses, doctors, lab technicians, community health workers of the future. And it's up to us as a community to embrace these. And so the Black nurses, we want to be the intermediary that brings all the stakeholders together. So for so long, people have been working in silos, doing
yes.
their own things without regards to the impact, or things have been falling between silos. What we bring to the table is we know the partners that need to be at the table. We know the ones who are really doing the work, and we want to be there to make sure those people, together with the other organizations, get together so we can map out a strategy and help to get that done.
Okay. All right.
Public health model.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
Mr. Allen, anything else? And I think that'd be a good point to kind of wrap it up and thank our guest. It certainly represents significant food for thought. Both physically and mentally, of the African-American community.
Yes, and I'd just like to say thank you to Ms. Sherilyn LaChapelle. And I also just, in closing here, I would hope that you'd be able to attend the North Minneapolis Public Relations Task Force. The first meeting is next Saturday at Sunnyside, because your input will be very valuable. And we also like to welcome she's not on the air, but we'd like to welcome North Minneapolis, who we nicknamed terrorist, Megan Goodmanson, tuning in on Blog Talk Radio today. But with that Sherilyn LaChapelle, thank you for calling in, and stay tuned, and we hope to get an update from you real soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Don, something that came to mind as I was listening to our last speaker, I was looking at a headline here in the Omaha paper this morning, U.S. expresses regret over experiments in Guatemala. You know, that's quite a story. It was really the genesis for me asking her the question about experimental medicine. And, of course, in Minnesota, one of the legendary fighters, if you will, who put everything on the line was Liz Samuels. But there was also a group of physicians such as Dr. Posey, Dr. Thomas Johnson, just legendary, who were calling attention to these experiments. Now, this situation in Guatemala very quickly, and it is relevant to what we are talking about. You know, in 1946 to 1948, the United States was involved in appalling violations of medical ethics.
Yes.
In Guatemala, okay, by the injection of infectious diseases and et cetera. Now, you have to understand, this is the same United States that in 1948 was finally apologizing after they were exposed by a medical professor at the University of Rochester in New York for doing the same thing, ironically, Don, 10 years prior to who? African Americans in what is one of the great criminal medical episodes in the history of this country, the Tuskegee experiment. Just so our listening audience, both domestic and international, understand the reason for the question to the last caller about their position on experimental medicine in America. Now, like I said, it took over 60 years, 70 years, in fact, you know, for the United States of America, well, 60, to confirm what had been rumored for many, many, many years within the Central American health community, that this country, from 1946 to 1948, experimented with such things as AIDS, HIV infections, as they had done and were doing at the same time in the Congo, okay? I refer us in closing to the book The River by a man by the name of Hooper, who did a 10-year study. But it was ironic, Mr. Allen, that it was just 10 years prior that the United States got caught in Tuskegee and in 1948 apologized and said we would do nothing like that ever again in God's blue heaven, if you will. And they were conducting a very comprehensive government-sponsored program of medical genocide. Thank you, sir.
Great. All right, then. Well, moving along, Mr. Edwards, you know, today also I was at the Fong Lee rally in North Minneapolis. About 100, 150 people stood on the corners of 34th and 4th Avenue there, right in front of City View School. And if anybody wants to see those videos or photos, you can go to IBNNnews.com and check those out and look at the video. And I had an opportunity to speak with one of the Hmong elders over there.
Okay.
Who it was very articulate and was troubled by the lack of initiative or action by the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights. Chief Tim Dolan, Minneapolis Police Chief Tim Dolan, Mayor R.T. Rybak, and folks involved in the investigation on the city's level, or the lack of investigation on city levels for the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights. And I was able to share some of my experiences, if you will, with them, and that goes on to moving toward the YMCA and the September 9th incident with Mr. Smith, David Cornelius Smith, who our contact, Mr. Edwards, who will remain nameless at this point, who actually called on point and let us know that this man was pronounced dead on the sixth floor of the YMCA.
And on the 9th of September, correct?
On the 9th of September, after the police tased him, and allegedly he was handcuffed. And we'll put it like that, but we know otherwise what was going on there, and handcuffed and tased, and pronounced dead on the floor, on the 6th floor of the YMCA in downtown Minneapolis on the 9th of September. And then the later reports, which you broke the story, later reports, we hear that he's on life support at HCMC.
Mm-hmm.
And then 10 days later, on the 18th, the machines are taken away, and then he's pronounced dead. Mr. Edwards, do you know or can you explain why that spin on this particular incident, why the YMCA, I've tried contacting Casey Reed, the executive director of the downtown Minneapolis YMCA, and also Betty Fenton, who is the communications director at the main office on Hennepin Avenue over there, southeast Minneapolis, and no one seems to want to get back. No one wants to seem to supply videotapes or anything, and this gets back to what I call the Fong Lee syndrome. You know, are the tapes being sanitized right now? So,
well, let me respond to that, Mr. Allen, here on point. The Civil Rights Department, let's go back to them first, in the case of Fong Lee, and then move ahead to both Quincy Smith, young African-American tased to death by the police in the middle of the street in North Minneapolis in December 2008, a year later, notice how I said that, a Hennepin County grand jury declined to indict, if you will, and then we move on to David Cornelius Smith on September 9th of 2010, is tased to death on the 6th floor of the YMCA. Now, we were puzzled by the lack of response when myself, and others made a formal request, which you have documented on your website, asking a civil rights director, Velma Quarbel, to initiate under color of law. We talked about that last week, the importance of that word. Under color of law, to investigate the violation of the civil rights of David Cornelius Smith, as the Civil Rights Department under Michael Jordan was asked to do the same thing in December of 2008 as it pertains to Quincy Smith. The department both times declined. Now, in the case of Ms. Quarbel, we began to realize that part of that was the relationship between the YM and the YW. Ms. Quarbel sits as the chair of the exec committee of the board of directors of the YWCA. And, of course, there is a both historical, political, and financial relationship between the two organizations. Now, that takes us back to Fong Lee. One of the things that came up in the trial in May of 2009, again, anybody that wants to challenge us, go spend some money, go get a transcript of the trial proceedings, or reach out to the Fong Lee family if you got the guts to do it on this issue, or call Mike Patton. In August of 2006, our friends, loved ones, family of Fong Lee went to the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. At that time, a man by the name of Michael Brown, who has now since returned, was at that particular site. The citizens went in and asked for a federal investigation, and also asked for a investigation by the city of Minneapolis. So they had gone over to the U.S. Attorney's Office, but more importantly, they went to the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, and there was a lot of discussion about the fact that the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department was going to do something. I doubted it from the get-go. One of the things that emerged at trial 3 years later, in May of 2009, was that the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department took statements from some of the individuals who were witnesses or had knowledge relevant to the death of Fong Lee on the 22nd of July, 2006. And Mr. Allen, they fed that information back to the police. And it was one of the reasons that so many witnesses, particularly those in the Asian and specifically in the Hmong community, and specifically those who were friends of Fong Lee, were intimidated and became the target of police retaliation. I repeat that again. The Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, during the latter part of 06 and into early 07, passed information back to the Minneapolis Police Department identifying potential witnesses, which was a gross violation of the intent and the requirements of the law. And we talked about that back then. But like I said, in testimony in May of 2009, that revealed itself. So to your specific question, unfortunately, there's a pattern in practice that has emerged in which really the Civil Rights Department has a tendency to act as an agent, if you will, and a proxy for the city and for the system, irrespective of right or wrong. And in most cases, it's wrong. And until a federal grand jury or someone is prepared to look at that, this Mike Freeman in the county is not going to look at it, they will continue to do that. But they passed information back to the police. They identified witnesses. They provided to the police the statements of the witnesses. And a lot of these folks were intimidated. In fact, a key African-American witness who lived just on top of the hill where in a duplex, actually was held persona non grata during the trial. In fact, Mike Patton will tell you that he attempted to subpoena this man. He was moved from the Hennepin County Jail to the jail in Carver County, and Judge Paul Magnuson would not invoke his authority as the presiding judge of the trial to order that this African-American be brought back into Hennepin County and be produced, and that was crucial. But the reason that this gentleman began to take those kinds of hits because the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department provided his statement to the police.
Whoa, and that's just what, that's going to lead me into this next piece here, Mr. Edwards. When we talk about the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights and their lack of process, follow-through, and I currently have one case with them, and they're feeding all the information to a former employer because someone that works on the inside calls me about once a week and says, Don, these people are telling us everything. I said, perfect. Okay. So I know that. So I know they're doing that. But I went down because the gentleman, his name is Eric Johnson. He's the vice chair of the Jordan Area Community Council and the head – and he, and also, I'm trying to get out Michael Kip Brown, who is the investigative supervisor at the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, is the chair of this community organization.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this Eric Johnson compares his neighbors who are black to rats, but his rats are better because they know who their mothers and fathers are.
Right.
And black men are thugs and black women are thuggerinas. So I felt it was a violation of my civil rights for this community guy to be, in charge of a community organization, a vice chair, and his chairman sitting there you know, handsomely in the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights and not shutting him down, not giving him a pull-up, you know, not saying, hey, you can't really do that. And I went down there to file. So I actually recorded the interview, and I would like to just play a little bit of it, if that would be okay, here we go.
The Jordan area.
Are you recording or are you not recording?
No, I had to turn my phone off.
Oh, okay.
The Jordan area community council vice chair, his name is Eric Johnson. He continues to compare African Americans to rats, and that and black women are thuggerinas, and also. Also, he continues to use his power in the black community as the Jordan area vice chair.
He continues, like...
Yeah, he has a blog. This is just one thing right here that he's written. And on his... I can put the URL on there so you can look it up. And he's also written things that... that African-Americans, rats are better than African-Americans because African-Americans know, I mean, rats know who their mothers and fathers are. And so I am actually filing this suit against the chair, which is Michael Kitt Brown, and Eric Johnson, the vice chair, for continuing to let this go on.
Okay. Well, are you filing the lawsuit somewhere else?
No.
Because, as you know, we don't file lawsuits here.
This is a violation of civil rights.
Right, but it's a complaint.
No. I'm making a complaint.
Right, but we don't do lawsuits because when you refer to...
I understand exactly what
you
do here.
Okay. I just want to make sure because you said you want to file a lawsuit. So, I have to talk to Mr. Brown about this because, as you know, he's the assistant director in the complaint investigations unit, and this sounds to me like a conflict of interest.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Edwards.
Yes, sir.
That was Ms. Monica Diaz, who is acting as a intake person in training, who on that day said, on the 21st, who said that this would be a conflict of interest, and then followed through with a letter saying it was a conflict of interest. And I'm going to publish the whole interview here in the next couple of hours, so people can actually listen to that to see how lackluster, uninformed, and without a clue about their own ordinance for the department they work in, that these people have.
So. Let me do this, Mr. Allen, again, for the purpose of historical transparency with our both domestic and international audience on this. And you may even want to give the number. Maybe some of that Northside group that says that they don't like what we're saying, maybe they'll have the guts to call in. One of the things that's, I think, excellent that you did in recording her response. And by the way, she is in a position of public trust. That's number one. So you did not violate, quote unquote, her rights by recording her response. Again, she is a public official in a position of public trust. Consequently, there's a certain standard which she is expected to execute, if you will, in that position under color of law. First of all, Ms. Diaz came to the Civil Rights Department a couple of years ago as a temp, okay? She suddenly became a permanent employee receptionist, if you will, and then went from receptionist to liaison to the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, which is a established position with significant increase in salary, and then just a number of months ago she received another, quote-unquote, significant promotion and et cetera. But she started out as a temp. Now, she said to you on the tape, and we recommended as a co-host last week that we certainly hoped that you called upon Susan Siegel, the city attorney for the city of Minneapolis, to convene an immediate meeting. Because, you know, one of the things that Ms. Diaz did in that recording that you have was that she indicated a legal position without a proper examination. She said this constitutes a conflict of interest. First of all, she is not a legal practitioner. She does not do this on a daily basis. What she does do on a daily basis on the occasions that she shows up for work is basically never at her position, okay, never at the front desk, never around where she's supposed to be. But she said to you on this tape that you just played for our audiences, domestic and international, she said she had already made a determination of a conflict of interest. First of all, in order to do that, you have to research the law, and then you have to, in the case of yourself, Mr. Allen, you have to cite the specific authority. And when I say authority, I'm talking about legal authority, which is predicated upon case law, okay? You know, white folks teach us and train us that every niche and every day. So she needed to have cited to you what constituted a conflict of interest as opposed to an issue of jurisdiction. I shared with our listening audience, I think, in week two of the inauguration of this radio program, that I still have three cases pending before the Civil Rights Commission, none of them having anything to do with me, but having to do with a violation of the ordinance. In two of the cases involving Mortenson and the Minnesota Ballpark Authority, the department said they didn't have jurisdiction. Now, there's a difference between jurisdiction and conflict of interest. Persons who are legal practitioners who are trained in the law know what we're saying here on point. But she violated, in addition to the issues that you raised on why you were filing this charge, she violated your civil rights under color of law by indicating in a so-called prima facie manner that she had already made a determination. But then she said to you that she would get with Mr. Brown, who is the person who is at the center of the conflict of interest, and would confer to him. Her responsibility was, number one, to confer with the director of the department, Velma Corbell, and Ms. Corbell's responsibility was to immediately contact the city attorney, who is the legal counsel to the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, and then begin to research the issue and make a formal recommendation. The other thing that they did not do in closing, sir, is that, and Mr. Allen has shared with me the special delivery letter that came to him last week, in which they told him that there was a conflict of interest. The ordinance and the law requires that in indicating there was a conflict of interest, they were then to refer you to another jurisdiction. Did they do that, Mr. Allen?
No. They right. told me. I published a letter that they sent. It's on IBNN News, and it's under the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights. Let me just get the title here real quick. Resignations are in order.
I mean, absolutely, because who they were supposed to refer you to on this particular matter was the State Department of Human Rights, where Ms. Corbell and Mr. Brown just came from after non-distinguishable service, if you will. But they were, by law, they were to have referred you to an alternative source, okay? She also tried to play the game about lawsuits. The fact of the matter is, and you're talking to a person that helped, as I said before, helped write this ordinance 30-some years ago, is that the Civil Rights Department does have the authority to file lawsuits. That's why they are vested with the right to go into district court in the state of Minnesota and take certain actions when they make certain determinations, which are concurred with by the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, which technically and by ordinance is a separate entity. So you're talking to a person who had, she didn't have a clue, but what happened was, even though she is a person of Hispanic extraction, if you will, she was very comfortable thinking that you were just some dumb black man that she was talking to, and she could run that kind of game at you, and that was supposed to suffice. And this is what has become the legacy of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department under R.T. Ryback and the city of Minneapolis.
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't agree more 100% with you. I mean, I just don't know how you, short of getting like 1,000 people down there to protest in front of the building, I mean, I don't know how you get those folks down there to do anything.
You can't, and you know, as one who was at the heart of the controversy creating the Civil Rights Department 42 years ago, and all this is on file. In fact, they still teach the course at the University of Minnesota. I've got to tell you that I'm just not sure that we're not at a point where the Civil Rights Department should, in fact, be placed in receivership reorganize and just kind of start all over again if we're really talking in terms of doing something meaningful to protect the franchise and the rights of the protected class, quote-unquote, minorities and et cetera. And I really hate using that word in this country. But all you've got now is a bunch of people who, first of all, are playing musical chairs, going back and forth from the Human Rights Department to the Civil Rights Department, making, in some cases, a six-figure salaries, if you will, taking a lot of leisure time, basically can't be found, working basically a 3 to 4 day week at best, if you will. And in the meanwhile, tensions continue to rise. You know, as you know, Mr. Allen, we had a major confrontation a week ago tomorrow in North Minneapolis, a full-scale riot where over 200 young African Americans routed the police in a fight over a memorial service where African Americans, loved ones of a young man who was shot and killed 53 weeks ago this week in front of Burger King's. People came to merely have a memorial to try to talk in terms of the importance of peace and et cetera. The police set on them, beat the mother to the ground, if you will. Unfortunately, she is going to be returned in the penitentiary, if you will. This is a mother who just agonized over what happened, went to leaders this time last year asking them to get involved. They didn't do it. But the fact of the matter is the Civil Rights Department was created to review, investigate, and serve as a positive force in situations like this. Now, you and I were talking earlier before we went on the air. You were in a conversation in the barbershop this morning, black men talking about the fact that since the battle on last Sunday and another incident on Monday in which a white police officer was bloodied, that the police have been beating Negroes in the streets for the last 5 days in Minneapolis, unmercifully. I mean, they're riding in like death squads, if you will. They're jumping out of their SUVs and et cetera. And, I mean, they are beating the crap out of young African Americans. They're breaking ribs. They're breaking noses. They're breaking feet. They're knocking out teeth, if you will. And it is absolutely out of control. And unless Todd Jones, the United States Attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota, decides to get up and do something, we're going to have some real tragedies around here. And I think it's a doggone shame. And folks, both within our domestic and international listening audience, need to understand just how perilous it is up there in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yes, and I always like to let people know here, you can call in at 1-877-572-4288. Again, that number is 1-877-572-4288. Any comments, concerns, questions, feel free to call. We'll be there. Also, Mr. Edwards, I want to talk about real quick here and moving on. Next Tuesday, October 5th at 7 p.m., for those of you that are listening from Minneapolis, Mr. Edwards and I will be hosting the 5th Congressional District debate on Minneapolis Television Network. Again, at 7 p.m. till 8 p.m., and afterwards there's a meet and greet at J.D. Hoyt's on 3rd and Washington North in downtown Minneapolis. We have 4 out of the 5 candidates confirmed. And
who's not trying to be a Republican?
No. The Democrat. Democrats,
you mean the current incumbent congressman, Congressman Keith Ellis?
Yeah, it's really funny because I listen to NPR most of the day in the office, around the house, even on Saturdays and Sundays. And I just heard yesterday, you know, Congress is out of session, and the email that I got from his handler said that he has to make a very important vote on Tuesday the 5th. He'll be in D.C. I said, okay, I don't have the internet. I can't look this schedule up, okay? And then I forwarded him back the schedule. I said, come on, you know, I just look like this. Give me a break. Okay.
Wow.
And so,
that is just wild. Because I just watched an interview with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who, by the way, her husband is one of the, along with her, is one of the big investors in the United Football League. Oops, how things tie together. And I mean, she was spending an inordinate amount of time talking in terms there would be nothing happening in the House because everybody is back home to try to get reelected. I cannot believe that the congressman's office was that haphazard with respect to his availability. I'm sad that he won't be with us on the 5th, but as I understand it, we will be moving ahead with this live debate. Correct?
Yes. Oh, you know I ordered a cutout. I mean, either he shows up or the cutout is going to be standing there behind the podium or in front of the podium or wherever we choose to put it. And we just want to let people know this is going to be streamed on Minneapolis Television Network, that's mtn.org, and also On Point on Blog Talk Radio. You'll be able to hear behind the scenes starting at 6 p.m. and then the broadcast at 7. You'll be able to hear the whole thing. Well, we'll get an opportunity to bring people over to the studio, and actually the remote studio is going to be at the Minneapolis Television Network, and we'll be able to interview people right there on the spot, even an hour ahead of time. And so you can kind of get the behind the scenes of what's going on and hear what's happening. So we should make it pretty exciting. And also I want to also let people know that, again, the North Minneapolis Public Relations Task Force, the first meeting is Saturday, the 9th of October, from 11 to 1 p.m. at Sunnyside Deli. Come prepared to support a small business and buy breakfast, $10.99. And also the reason why we're doing this, Mr. Edwards, is because the Northside Marketing Task Force created a couple of years ago has not done anything. They have not been active in creating a different kind of perception or awareness for North Minneapolis. They haven't done any lobbying for the for North Minneapolis. It just they just sit there stagnant, and the vice chair and the chair refuse to return telephone calls. And I understand actually the chair.
And who are they, by the way? I mean, let's get the names out there. Who are these folks?
The chair was a lady by the name of Sue Bendixson, who recently resigned, was the last thing I was told. And now the person kind of running it is Georgina Yantos, who is also on the Hawthorne Neighborhood Group or Council. And,
oh, I see.
And then she shows up at the Jordan meeting. She's all across the board. And
Are there any black folk who know anything about, marketing and development, anything like that?
There's a few, I guess. And I'm hoping to get them together. And I mean,
is there a prohibition against having African-Americans on those kinds of committees? I mean, she's not an African-American, is she?
No, she's not. But there's a prohibition of having people that know what they're doing on those type of committees.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah. I asked the wrong question. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, you could have black, white, red, yellow, just as long as there's a process in place. There's not an intimidation strategy going because you're on. I went to one of the meetings, and I normally look to the chair. I just, hello, Madam Chair. Thank you for inviting me here today to talk to the Northside Marketing Task Force.
Right.
And then out of the corner, I hear Ms. Yantos asking me all these questions. And I'm saying, well, why are you? I mean, are you? And people have come back to me that are currently on the Northside Marketing Task Force board and says, she has to go. She has to go. And, I mean, it's okay. She was there from the beginning, and I know there's a territory or boundary issue there, but, it gets kind of ridiculous when you have a group of people in North Minneapolis who are interested in moving the black folks out and making it their urban utopia, and they form the NOMI group over there, and the Northside Marketing Task Force is sitting on its hands. So it's time to do something different and just move ahead. And despite what these people say, and hopefully people show up and we can get something going. It's a volunteer board, and we just want to make some things happen and be a little different.
I can understand. We have about 10 minutes left, Mr. Allen, as we look at the big clock. Let me ask a question here because we both attended. You actually spent more time than I did. The genesis for my comments is this month's edition the October edition of Ebony, which talks about, this is Ebony now. This is not Don and Ron kind of thing. It says, is black leadership dead? And last Saturday at North High School, there was a meeting dealing with a report on the African-American community and its health and wellness, if you will. Also, there was something on the children coming back to school that by the Urban League up at the Y, which I'm not quite sure. And then our good friend Bishop Howell was supposed to have what was being touted for almost a month as a significant discussion at the conclusion of a march from Henry back to Shiloh International Ministries, which apparently didn't happen. What is the plan, if you will? How are we going to be moving to disprove this article in last month's edition of Ebony that is Black leadership dead? I mean, Kevin Powell, who writes in Ebony, said Black leadership is dead.
Yes.
Michael Eric Dyson, a brilliant mind, talks in terms that there are problems, and he uses the in the wake of Sherelle Sharon. Where are we at? I mean, how did the thing go? I mean, was the assessment?
Here goes the assessment. You know, at some point, you know, you have to get all levels, all the thirds together. You have Gary Cunningham and Trista Harris. Gary Cunningham with the North Side or the Northwest Area Foundation. Trista Harris with the Headwaters Foundation. You have the Urban League and the Al McFarland Group and the Bill English Group, and then you have the Al Flowers Group. Okay.
Okay.
Now you have three significant, you know, in 9 minutes here, we have three significant thirds. Okay. We have someone dealing with the lower third of the community. You have some people dealing with the mid-range third, and then you have the folks dealing with the bougie types. And so at some point, all three of those groups are going to have to sit down to the table with people that they don't want to be at the table with to start forming a plan and a process, because each, like our Ms. LaChapelle said, you know, we've been working in silos in the Black community, and we can't get anything done.
I call them bunkers, actually, but go ahead. Yeah,
bunkers,
I understand what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, we can't get anything done. I mean, even if we sit there and we say there's a heinous action at the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. We need, you know, we know folks are working. Can you come down during your lunch hour for an hour, you know, if you work downtown, and let's have a protest on the corner? You're lucky to get two people. Okay.
Right.
And if you tell these other folks to come up and do something, they're not interested in even helping. And what amazed me at this event, and my assessment real quick here of the event, is that, you know, there are some key elements missing. There is no after plan, you know. There is no agenda. At least we could have had some kind of agenda or follow up or follow through, so people would know that hey, we want to do this or go this direction, that direction, which makes me think that, you know, it was another dog and pony funding show.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. So, I mean, yeah. Okay. Well, maybe we'll hear some more. You know, some of us are still asking a question coming out of the so-called historical leadership conference, which was attended by 150 people at General Mills. We've talked about that. Because there was never any follow-up. In fact, there was supposed to be a second meeting, a follow-up meeting in April of this year. It never happened. Now you're told that you cannot ask Mr. Cunningham or the Northwest Area Foundation any questions. Everything has been shifted over to the Headwaters Foundation. I'm not sure I understand what that means.
Mr. Evers, on that note right there, if our listeners locally and internationally want to call up the Insight News, there's a front page story, Forum Calls for a Process Driven by Public Policy. Now, here's what's happening. We're not getting any pre-news. We're getting post-news. So these folks are Trista Harris, Gary Cunningham, Robert Jones, Tony Carter, Alfred Babington Johnson has come out of the woodwork. And a couple other folks are having these meetings to decide, and this is the upper one-third, okay? This upper one-third wouldn't have anything to do with the Al Flowers.
Okay.
They wouldn't have much to do with a Scott Gray at the Urban League, who closed his group home when there's over 300 homeless veterans in the state.
Right.
And so, you know, you see this going on, and you see it publicized that this is important, when actually their neglect of the other two-thirds makes it a heinous, you know, event. I mean, a bogus, heinous, and it just – you have to have all parties together. At some point, Mr. Gary Cunningham and Trista Harris have to get down and decide that, okay, we might not like this person over here, but we have to have them at the table, period. Until that point,
absolutely.
Yeah, until that point, we're just going to run around in circles. And that's why the police beat us up. That's why the Ackerberg Group is able to come to North Minneapolis with Don Samuels and do what they want to do. That's why KMLJ had no African-American appraisers, contractors, or attorneys to guide them so they could own the Five Point building rather than rent it. That's why the school board can just come in and build a district headquarters on Broadway Avenue, because who's going to say anything? Who's going to no one's organizing the people at the grassroots level. You know, you have.
By the way, again, for the transparency and for the listening audience, the school district will build a building with taxpayers' money that the district will not own for 20 years. And again, these are statements made by current incumbents of the board doing a candidates forum, has been further amplified and confirmed. And I'm still trying to figure out how you work that kind of scheme. Okay.
Yeah.
And the only person that makes a significant profit is Mortensen, who will make a profit of $1 million based on how they will fund and raise the necessary monies and assets, if you will. I don't know. It does make a lot of sense. And by the way, as we said here on point, there also will be no African-Americans who will be employed on that site. You know, contrary to, quote-unquote, all these so-called governance and oversight committees that are being formed. And I think you have something that you'll be breaking next week. We'll do it that way.
Yes.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But anyway, Don, we're down to the last, 3 minutes?
Two and a half minutes.
Anything else we have here on a, as I said before, again, a beautiful Saturday here in Omaha, and we were just delighted to be able to fellowship with the UFL players and movers and shakers here in Omaha, Nebraska. Anything on your end, my friend?
Well, I'd just like to let people know to tune in. If you live in Minneapolis, it's Channel 17, Minneapolis Television Network, at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, October 5th. And if you're international or national, you go to Minneapolis Television Network, MTN.org, and there should be a link there for the Minnesota 5th Congressional Debate hosted by myself and Mr. Ron Edwards. And then Mr. Ron Edwards has his weekly column in this Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. That's www.spokesman-recorder.com, or pick up a copy or call him for a subscription, yearly subscription. You can see most of the stuff we talked about today in the letter in the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, and also the Urban League closing its group home at IBNNnews.com. That's the Independent Business News Network online, 24 hours a day, 65 days? Yeah, 60, I forgot how many days are in a year, real quick.
Yeah, 364.
Yeah. I just got thrown off here. I was just looking out in Minneapolis and kind of envying you being in that warm weather down in Omaha, and I'm sitting up here. I'm in a beautiful studio, but, you know, I'd rather be out and about watching a football game, you know, live.
Well, let me just say this. We want to thank our host here in Omaha and special studios that were set up here at the Crown Plaza in Northwest Omaha. I tell you, man, it's been a delightful, and like I said, we'll finish up our sojourn with a trip to Alliance, Nebraska, and be something that you and I will be jointly putting together as a documentary in December. But want to thank our audience sharing their time with us, and us being able to share our time and the exchange of information and et cetera. And I'm on my way to the football game.
Well, you have a wonderful time, and we'd like to thank everybody again, like you said, and join us same time next week, 4 p.m. Central Standard, or On Point.
Thank you. All right. Take care, my friend.